So today we are going to talk about the third dimension in invariant generation, which is program transformations. And after that, we would revisit our problem of symbolic bound computation and see how we can apply these various principles that we have learned to compute precise symbolic bounds. So I have put down some examples of these transformations that I know of, which alleviate the need to compute sophisticated invariants. And I'm going to talk about two of them, control flow refinement and quantitative attributes instrumentation. So there are two others, which I'm not going to talk about, but I'll just briefly mention. I'll actually talk about loop flattening, though. So the last two transformations, loop flattening and loop peeling, they help reduce the need for disjunctive invariants. So loop flattening simply means that you take the loop body and explicitly enumerate all the paths inside the body and then do the analysis over the expanded control flow graph in the loop. Loop peeling refers to the transformation in which you just extract the first iteration of the loop, or you unroll the first iteration of the loop and then do your analysis. And this is sometimes useful to avoid the need for computing disjunctive invariants, especially when something interesting happens in the first iteration of the loop, when it sets some parameters. So there, this transformation comes in very handy. Another thing which unfortunately I won't have time to talk about is this thing about having a non-standard choice of cut points, or maybe join points, the places in the program where you decide to lose information. And if you are a bit careful about this, then also there are several examples where you can avoid the need to compute disjunctive invariants. So disjunctive invariants are not so easy to compute. And today we will talk about a technique to compute disjunctive invariants. But some places you can avoid it. And these are some of the techniques that you can use to avoid computing disjunctive invariants, but not always. And so here are some references that I have put up regarding these transformations that I know of. So we'll cover just two. I'll start with control flow refinement. So this is a transformation that helps you transform a loop which has multiple paths into code fragment with simpler loops that have less number of paths, or preferably only a single path. So let me actually talk about an example that motivates this transformation. And this example is also in one of the puzzles that I gave you to compute bounds of. This was, I think, figure 3A, the Q1 example. So did people try to work out the bound for the example Q1 in the assignment? So is it even terminating always? Yeah, Q1, yeah. M, okay. So I'm even asking a simpler question, right? Not even give me the bound, but just tell me if it is terminating or not. So since you are giving me a bound, you are implicitly implying that the program always terminates. So this program is not even terminating always, because yes, there's some of weird corner case. So is it right, Florian? Do you recall? No, you don't have assignment. Okay, so I'm not sure, but let's not spend too much time on it. But there's some corner case under which this is non-terminating, and I guess you probably have figured it out. But if you put this condition that n is greater than 0 and less than m, then this program is terminating. And as you rightly pointed out, m is a upper bound on the number of loop iterations for this example. So let's see how we can apply this transformation to make this reasoning almost trivial for this example. So understanding that the bound is m is not so easy for automated techniques, but after applying this transformation, we will see that it is almost trivial to reason about this example. So to apply this transformation, or to understand what this transformation really does, I will convert this program into a transient system representation form, where I have simply pulled in the loop guard x not equal to n as an explicit guard for the two paths inside this loop. So as you can observe, this loop has two paths, which I'm calling as P1 and P2. And I'm simply using the primed versions of the variables to denote the update to those variables. Now, what this loop suggests is that the paths P1 and P2, they can interleave arbitrarily. Right? This is what the syntactical structure of this transition system suggests, that you can either execute path P1 or you can execute path P2 in any transition. But the key to observe, the key observation here is that path P1 and P2 cannot interleave in an arbitrary fashion. So what happens is that the path P1 executes first, and it raises the value of x to be equal to m. And then path P2 executes when x is reset to 0. And then path P1 executes again when x reaches the value n, and therefore you terminate. So in other words, the syntactic structure of the code P1 or P2 star, which suggests that P1 and P2 can interleave in any arbitrary fashion, can be refined to this regular expression, which explicitly syntactically suggests that it is the path P1 that will execute first one or more times, followed by only one execution of path P2, followed by one or more execution of paths P1. So if you can do this refinement, if you can automatically figure out that P1 or P2 star in this particular case, it can be refined to this syntactical interleaving of these paths, then you can very easily compute a bound, right? So let's say if we can figure this out, then this program gets transformed into this program where the path P1 executes first, then path P2 executes only one time, and then path P1 executes again one or more times. And now it's very easy to read off the bound, because you know from the first loop, we can figure out that this loop goes for m minus n iterations. And then you have one iteration here, and then you have n iterations here. And if you add all of them up, you will get m plus 1, which is an upper bound on the number of loop iterations here. So is everyone with me? Like, how did a simple, well, not a simple, but how did a program transformation avoided the need to reason about fancy invariants? Because otherwise, if you want to reason about the number of iterations here by, say, using a counter instrumentation, then you will need to compute disjunctive invariants on that counter. But after this reduction, the reasoning almost becomes trivial. You can just use pattern matching to figure out how many iterations the first loop goes, how many iterations the second copy of the loop goes. So let's see how we can actually do this transformation, how we can refine P1 or P2 star to P1 plus, P2, P1 plus. So recall the algebraic equivalence, where a regular expression P1 or P2 star can be thought of as either the empty string, or which means that the no path, the loop does not execute at all, or the loop execute once, where path P1 or P2 can execute, and then the loop again executes zero or more times. Right? This is also a simple equivalence on regular expressions. And this kind of equivalence is used to compute fixed points using an iterative forward style algorithm. So recall how abstract interpretation works or how model checking works. They try to figure out they propagate the state before the loop by doing a transformation over the loop body, and then they iteratively try and recursively try to again keep doing this till you reach a fixed point. But now observe another different algebraic equivalence. You can also rewrite P1 or P2 star using this equivalence, which says that either the loop does not execute, or it is only the first path that executes, or only the second path that executes, or these are the two other interesting cases. So this says that either it is the path P1 that executes first, followed by an execution of P2, or it is the path P2 that executes first, followed by an execution of path P1. So only these five different cases are possible in this algebraic equivalence. And the difference between these two equivalences is that this equivalence focuses on the action when paths really start interleaving. So when P1 transitions to execution of P2, which is very evident in this particular case. So we are looking at the step when you start transitioning from P1 to P2, or you transition from P2 to P1. And this is the place where interesting action happens. So the control flow refinement actually uses this kind of algebraic equivalence to take a program and take a loop and rewrite it into simpler loops. So the idea is that we're going to expand a loop using this rule, And then as you can see that this expansion can be recursive because you can recursively expand these loops. So the question is, when do we stop? So the answer is that we are going to use some kind of invariant generation tool to check which of these cases is indeed feasible, and then accordingly decide whether we recursively need to expand or not. So by just using the simple algebraic equivalence, you can convert that example that I showed you earlier into the more refined one in which the path P1 executed first, then P2, and then again path P1. And again, the idea behind this expanded code fragment is that this expanded code fragment has simpler loops. So the definition of simpler loops is loops which have just one transition or loops that have relatively less number of transitions, because then you don't have to worry about the interleavings between them because you have already analyzed them here. And now the idea is that you have a program with simpler loops and you use invariant generation tools to compute invariants of these simpler loops. But these invariants actually correspond to disjunctive invariants in the original program. So this methodology that I have presented is not only useful for bound analysis, but in general for computing invariants about programs, disjunctive invariants. Okay, so let's talk about another such program transformation. And this program transformation will help avoid the need for computing heap invariants, especially invariants that talk about heap as well as arithmetic. So again, I will motivate this transformation by an example. This is another example on your assignment. This is a Q5 in question 3. So did someone figure out the bound for Q5? Is this even terminating? Okay, so no tricks, it is terminating. And now what's the bound for Q5? Did someone figure out? So what is the challenging aspect here, right? So we are iterating until the list to do becomes empty. So if this is the only action that happens inside the loop where we are deleting elements from the to-do list, we are probably in good shape. But the reason why this example is challenging is because we are adding elements to the to-do list also. So in each loop iteration, either we sometimes add an element to the to-do list or we delete an element from the to-do list. So the number of elements in the to-do list keeps increasing and decreasing, and therefore it's not so easy to reason about what is the number of loop iterations here or when will the to-do list become empty. So did people want to take a guess what is the number of loop iterations here? Yes, the length of the input list. And the way you can actually compute this, if you want to use counter instrumentation, so you simply instrument a counter C initialized to 0 at the beginning and incremented by 1 inside the outer loop, so what you do is we'll need to make the system understand the notion of what a length of a list really means. Because here the inputs to the procedure are not integer variables, so you cannot really express the bounds in terms of the variables directly. But the input is a list, and we would need to refer to some quantitative attributes of these input data structures. So in this particular case, in case when the data structure, input data structure is a list, one interesting quantitative attribute is the number of elements in the list. And let's say the system somehow understands what that means, and we can represent that by len of L, where len of L denotes the length associated with list L. Then it is possible to compute an inductive invariant that relates C with the lengths of various lists. And such an invariant can be generated by a tool that can reason about arithmetic and uninterpreted functions after you have made it understand the semantics of len. And this is exactly the join algorithm and the existential elimination algorithm or the iterative forward technique that we discussed yesterday. And once you eliminate the temporary variables to do, then you will get an invariant which will say C is less than or equal to old of len of L, and that's the bound for this loop. So let's see how we can make the system understand what is the meaning of len. Right? What does len really mean? Because once we make the system understand the meaning of len, then we can almost treat it as an uninterpreted function, and we can apply the algorithms that we studied yesterday regarding how to reason about combination of, how to discover invariants in the combined theory of arithmetic and uninterpreted functions. So the idea is actually pretty simple. So we will ask the user to describe. So the input L here is changing inside the procedure. So when I say old of len of L, it really means the length of the list L at the beginning of the procedure. Now, in order to express this invariant, I have to refer to the length of the list inside the loop at any arbitrary iteration, as well as the original length of the list L. And this is a common feature when you try to generate invariants, if the inputs of a procedure are changing, then you might want to copy those variables to some temporary variables, the original values of those variables, in order to be able to express interesting properties of programs. Because you want to relate the value of a variable with its original value at the beginning of the procedure. So normally, if you have integer variables, we don't typically see people writing programs that change the value of input parameters. But when you have data structure input variables, then it's quite natural, you know, to change the values of the heap that thing is pointing to. So in order to be able to express interesting properties, you need to be able to refer to the old values of those things. So you cannot simply make a copy of them by using a temporary variable. If it was an integer variable, you can just make a copy of it at the beginning, and you can just refer to that copy. But here, it's more challenging because L actually points to a huge set of memory locations through different fields. So the standard way to do this is to use the term old, which refers to the old value of L, or the old heap at the beginning of the program. So did that answer your question? So let's see how we can make the tool understand the meaning of what len is. And for this, we're going to take some help from the user, and we'll ask the user to define the meaning of len of L by describing the updates to this integral quantity by the different methods that a list supports. So for example, one of the standard methods that a list supports is the delete method. And there, the user simply has to say that it is going to decrement the value of len of L by 1. Or there's this move to method, which moves an element E from list L to the list L prime. And this has the effect of decreasing the length of list L by 1 and increasing the length of list L prime by 1. Now, once the user gives these quantitative attributes, then all that you have to do is to go back to the original program and see wherever these methods were being called and annotate the program or automatically instrument the program with these updates that the user has defined once and for all at the library level. And then we can do abstract interpretation or iterative forward techniques over combination of linear arithmetic and uninterpreted functions. Because once you do this instrumentation, len of L is exactly like an uninterpreted function. Because these axioms are capturing the meaning of what len essentially means. So so this reference that I have for this technique gives you examples of quantitative attributes for several other data structures, which you would need to express the bounds of several other examples that I have in this problem 3. So for example, for a tree, you might want to define the meaning of height of a tree, or the number of nodes in a tree. For bit vectors, you might want to refer to the number of total bits in the bit vector, or the number of 1 bits in the bit vector. And for list of lists, you might want to talk about the total number of nodes in all the nested lists. So did someone try to work out example Q6, which scans over a bit vector B? So you really have to use pen and paper to work this out. But I'll show you a technique which can be used to reason about this relatively easily. I think it has like two answers that I know of. One of the answers is number of 1 bits in the bit vector divided by 2. One answer trivially is the total number of bits in the bit vector, but you can give precise bounds. So one precise bound that I was mentioning was the number of 1 bits divided by 2. And there's one more that I don't recall now. But we'll see how to actually handle this example. But in order to be able to handle this example, we will at least need to know what some of the interesting quantitative attributes for bit vectors do mean. OK, so I'm done with my discussion on several dimensions in the theory of invariant generation. So first, we covered logic, where we talked about several decision procedures for several interesting logics. Then yesterday, we talked about three different techniques for computing fixed points, iterative technique, which comes in two flavors, forward and backward. And most of our discussion was on forward iterative techniques, which is what things like data flow analysis, abstract interpretation, model checking, they all use. We also talked about a new technique, which has been done in the past 4 or 5 years, which is called the constraint-based technique, The key idea was to reduce for all quantification to their existing quantification. And then we briefly talked about some very hacky and heuristic sounding techniques, which we were calling proof rules, which do not need to involve any of the fancy stuff here. And then today we talked about some of the program transformations. So now let's see how can we borrow most of the interesting stuff that we have been studying in the past two lectures to solve the problem of a symbolic bound computation. So this is joint work with Florian, who interned with us this summer. So do you want to raise your hand? Yeah, Florian. Yeah. So if you want to chat more about this problem, feel free to talk to him. So now the way I will try to sketch a solution to this problem is by following this methodology. And this I have found to be useful for solving several other problems related to reasoning about programs. So what you're essentially going to do is that instead of trying to solve the most general version for this problem, we're going to consider some very specific cases. So the first category of specific cases that we will consider is to bound the number of iterations of a given loop. So remember, the original problem was that given a control location, we want to compute a bound on the number of times a given control location is visited. So the first category of special cases would be that let's consider the case when this control location is immediately inside a loop, which reduces to saying, I am interested in counting the number of iterations of a given loop. But even this problem is quite hard. So I will again consider a very special case where I will consider the case when the loop whose iterations I want to bound has just one path or one transition. And then I will relatively, generalize this problem slowly. So all that we are given is a loop, while some condition, and a straight line code fragment, which assigns to the set of variables in the vector x. And we are going to use a transient system representation because it's very easy to describe all of our algorithms. And this transient system representation for this loop will be a simple formula, a conjunctive formula, which has the guard written here and the update to the primed version of the variables. So again, a simple example would be, as we've seen several times, that if you have a loop like this, so this is what I mean by a loop with one path or one transition. You can represent this loop by this formula which says x is less than n because only then this path is enabled. And then the new value of x is the old value of x plus 1, and the new value of n is the old value of n minus 1. So is everyone with me with respect to the transient system representation? The beauty of the transient system representation is that it's almost like what SSA form gives you, that you can think of the program as a formula. There is no need to, the sequencing is no longer important. Right? You just need to figure out, you can just think of it as a set of assignments or actually just as a formula. So this is the general algorithm that we are going to use for this. So what you're going to do is, we're going to find a ranking function R for this transition S. What's the ranking function? So R is the ranking function for S if S implies that the function is bounded below by 0. And the new value of R decreases by 1 in every loop iteration. Right? So if you can identify an expression which is bounded below by 0 and the value of that expression decreases by 1 in every loop iteration, then that expression will be a bound on the number of loop iterations. Right? Except that you have to just do max of 0, R for very much the same reasons that we discussed earlier. Now, there's one instantiation of this algorithm that we saw in the first lecture itself, where we said that we are going to instrument a counter C, and we are going to find an upper bound on the counter, upper bound n on the counter C. And max of 0, n will be an upper bound. So how does that follow as an instantiation of what we studied? Well, you can show that n minus C is a ranking function, and C is initialized to 0, so n is an upper bound on the number of loop iterations. So this was a technique that we saw, or that we alluded to in the first lecture. And how would you compute an upper bound on C? Well, the standard techniques that we know of are to compute use an iterative, forward iterative fixed point computation mechanism. But now what I'm going to tell you is that two other techniques which are going to work better than this iterative forward technique. So then the implicit suggestion here is that don't use this technique. Instead, use these other techniques which are more directed and probably even more scalable. So the reason why this is not we feel that this is not a very good technique to be used here is because this forward analysis will try to compute as precise information about the program as they can, and they're not really goal-directed. And we might end up computing a lot of information that we do not really require. And hence, the technique will not be scalable. But instead, consider the constraint-based approach for computing fixed points. And the idea here was that if you want to discover some invariant, or if you want to discover some quantity, and you kind of relatively know what form that invariant takes, which is what we refer to as a template, then you can set up the problems as solving some kinds of constraints. And if you know how to solve those kinds of constraints by translating, you know, the there exist or the for all quantifier into there exist, then we'll be in good shape. So this will be yet another application of Farkash lemma. So if you assume that your loop with one path has a ranking function, which is a linear ranking function, where A0 and AIs are the unknown coefficients you don't know, and Xis are the loop variables, and then you can simply say that there exists some AIs such that, you know, S implies this, that R is a ranking function. This is simply the definition of a ranking function. But now what you've done is that instead of trying to find an arbitrary ranking function, you're trying to limit your search to a ranking function which looks of this form. And now you have a constraint that you can actually solve using Farkash lemma, exactly the same way that we talked about earlier, how you can discover arithmetic invariants of this form using a Farkash lemma, which helps you translate for all quantifier into their exist quantifier and so on. And in this case, actually, you can show that for this special case, the problem just reduces to solving a bunch of linear inequalities for which you can do solve them in polynomial time. And this is, in fact, a complete method in the sense that there, if there exists a ranking function which is linear, then this method is complete. It will find that it will find the ranking function. And this, you know, beautiful result is described in this paper by Andrei Spodelsky and Andrei Rybalchenko. I think this is probably the first paper that Andrei Rybalchenko wrote. And if you look at, you know, usually some of the first papers that people write, they're sometimes very nice. The beauty of this technique is that this is very goal-directed, right? You're not trying to discover arbitrary facts about the program. You're right up to the very target. You know, you want to find a ranking function of this form. You set up constraints which exactly constrain A0s and AIs. So this technique is better than the iterative forward technique. There's another technique which I like even better, but it will not always work. If it doesn't work, you apply this technique. But other technique is very scalable. It is very general. It can find ranking functions of various forms, not only linear ranking functions. So can you guess what the technique would be? Do you recall what was the third fixed point computation technique? So you're reasoning about loops here, right? So to reason about loops, you need to choose a fixed point computation technique. So I already listed down two of the techniques. What is the third technique that we studied? The proof rules based technique, which does not require any iteration, which does not require solving any fancy constraints. But it requires you to understand what your domain is. It requires you to understand what are the design patterns that people use when they write loops. So next we will discuss the design of a rank computer, an algorithm that can find ranking functions for a variety of loops that people write in practice. So one of the most common iteration pattern that people write is for I is 0, I less than n, I plus plus, or, you know, I is decreasing by 1. Such a pattern can be captured, you know, precisely by this simple rule, which says, it's nothing more than the definition of a ranking function again. This says that if you can find an expression E such that E is a ranking function, exactly the definition of ranking function, then E is a ranking function. Nothing interesting here. The only interesting part is, how do I search for E, right? And here is the, and the simple suggestion is that you search for E by syntactically examining the transition S, right? So S is a formula. You syntactically examine S and see if you can find inequalities of the form E greater than 0. And you extract that expression E that by definition satisfies the first condition, and you see if that satisfies this condition also. Does the value of that expression E decrease by 1 in each loop iteration? If it does, this is your ranking function. So this simple proof rule works for a large fraction of loops that people write in practice. So one thing that I did not write down on the slide is that I have to decide my policy for choosing this expression E, and the policy is that I'm syntactically going to examine the transition S, convert all inequalities that I find over the unprimed variables in the form E greater than 0, extract that expression E, that by definition satisfies this constraint, but I'll have to check this constraint, and then I'm done. And how can we discharge this constraint? How are you going to check that this implication holds? We are going to use decision procedures, right? This was the content on the first day. So if you want to use proof rules, you can get away with just using decision procedures, which was the content of the lecture on the first day. And these decision procedures are today nicely implemented in SMT solvers. So if you want to use such decision procedures, you don't have to implement them. You can use these SMT solvers, which have been engineered to work, excellent on these small examples. And you can efficiently, you can rely on them for good. And they implement lots of different theories. So we'll talk about this as we see more and more patterns. So if we apply this pattern, then for this loop, we can find two ranking functions, right? Because so this loop, what it is doing is it has a guard which says I less than n and I less than m. And n doesn't change, but the value of m decreases in each loop iteration, or may decrease. And the value of I increases by 1 in every loop iteration. Right? So there are two ranking functions here. One is n minus I, and the second is m minus I. So how do I find this? Well, I syntactically examine this. I see two conditionals over unprimed variables, I less than n and I less than m. If I convert them into this form, I will get a conditional which says n minus I greater than 0. I verify that the value of n minus I decreases by 1 in every loop iteration. So n minus I is a ranking function. And the same exercise I can do for the expression m minus I. Here is another example which can be handled using this rule. Can someone tell me a ranking function for this example? And all that I have to do is to apply this rule. And I also told you the heuristic for searching for expressions E. So A is an array. So what this says is, I have a loop which executes only when n is greater than 0. The value of n may decrease by 1 in every loop iteration, not necessarily, may decrease. But I have another fact that I know about the loop, which says that I have an array A, and A of n is not equal to A of n prime, where n is the new value of n. And again, these are all real examples that I'm showing you. N, so n is a correct answer, and that answer should have come trivially when I told you that I'm going to, that there exists a ranking function, and I'm going to limit my search to inequalities of the form, e greater than 0, and I'm going to extract this, right? But do you know what was the reasoning that went into proving the second condition? Because it's not easy to see that n decreases by 1 in every loop iteration, right? It just says it may decrease, but not necessarily decreases by 1. So what was the reasoning that you folks used to give me the answer? Or you gave me the right answer for wrong reasons?
So the inequality A sub n not equal to A sub n can't be true if n is equal.
Exactly, right? This is a reason theory of uninterpreted functions has. And this is just the axiom for uninterpreted functions written in the contrapositive manner. And we studied the decision procedure for this. Remember the EDAC-based decision procedure? So this is all nicely implemented into several SMT solvers that are available, which you can just use off the shelf. And if you just use that solver, verify this thing, they will be able to verify this thing, and you figure out that n is a ranking function. So you see that this proof rule is very powerful, right? It's a very simple proof rule, but quite powerful. Here is another proof rule, which will give you a more precise answer. This proof rule is targeted to those loops which have a logarithmic bound, because they either decrease the value of a variable by at least 2 every time, so it's a logarithmic or multiplicative decrease or a multiplicative increase. So what it says is that if you can find an expression that is greater than or equal to 1, and the value of that expression decreases by a factor of 2 in every loop iteration, then log of E will be a ranking function. Right? It's not difficult to see why this is true. It's just a pattern, but it's quite effective. And again, how am I going to search for expression C? I'll use the same principle there. I will syntactically examine the transition S, look at all the inequalities over unprimed variables, normalize them in this form E greater than or equal to 1, extract E out of it, so it clearly satisfies this by definition, and then I will check whether this is true or not. So here are some examples of it. This is an example of a multiplicative decrease. So I can compute a bound of log I here. This is an example of multiplicative increase. I can compute a bound of log n of I here. And for binary search examples, this kind of proof rule will be excellent. Okay, now let me go on to another iteration pattern that people sometimes write. So what this says is, so this is targeted towards loops whose paths have just Boolean variables. Now, in practice, you will not find people writing loops which will just terminate in one iteration. Well, it still sometimes do actually, but it's not really the common case. But you have to realize that what you're really doing is we are examining only one path inside a loop. For now, we made the simplifying assumption that a loop has only one path. But in practice, loop will have multiple paths, but some of those paths will have exactly this kind of pattern, and it's quite common. So let's see what this pattern is really saying. So this pattern is really saying is that if you can find an expression E, a Boolean expression E, right? So E is not an integer expression now, E is a Boolean expression. Or maybe I should say if you can find an atomic formula E that is implied by S, but S implies the negation of that atomic formula after one transition, then it means that that transition can be executed only once. So the bound will be just one for such a loop. So this bool2int will just give you the integer variable corresponding to the Boolean expression E, and it can decrease by at most one, right? So the worst case decrease is that you start from one and you go to zero, and the loop only executes once. So there are two examples here. So let's say I have a loop which executes only when flag is true, and the effect of the loop body is to set flag to false. Right, now this loop executes for just one iteration. Right, here's an example of another loop. Let's say a loop executes only when the value of x is less than 100, but the loop body sets x to 100. So this loop will again execute for just one iteration. And this is quite a common pattern, not in the sense that people write loops which are just doing this, but one of the paths inside the loop has such a behavior. So you know that that path can execute only once. We just actually a few slides back, we saw an example where that was happening. Do you recall which example was that? Remember this example, P1 plus, P2, P1 plus? The path P2 could be executed only once, right? So this kind of pattern would be very useful to catch those cases. So these kind of paths exist inside loops because loops have different phases. So when they transition between different phases, they have such executions of such paths. So this pattern is specifically designed to handle those cases. So how did we come to know about such a pattern? Well, we didn't know when we started working on this problem. We implemented a very simple pattern earlier. We saw, you know, what it can handle and what it cannot handle. It handled most of the cases. Some of the cases it could not handle. We examined those cases. And then we saw that, you know, we can handle most of the cases which we are not able to handle by using this simple pattern. So this is how you come up with these different proof rules, right? To come up with these proof rules, you will need to understand the design patterns that the programmers are using. So this turned out to be an important design pattern that was there in the benchmark that we were looking at. This is another design pattern which people use when they iterate over bit vectors, and this pattern can be used to handle the example that you have here, Q6 example. So what this is saying is that if you can find a bit vector X, so what does LSB mean? Let me actually first explain LSB. So LSB denotes the position of the least significant one bit in a bit vector. So what this is saying is that if the position of the least significant one bit in some bit vector keeps decreasing in every loop iteration, and furthermore the loop executes only when the bit vector x is not equal to zero, so you keep shifting the one bit, you know, the least significant one bit, so eventually you will hit the case where the bit vector will be all zero and the loop will terminate, then the position of the least significant one bit is going to be a ranking function for this transition S. So this is one very common example where you keep shifting a bit vector by one in every iteration, and the position of LSB keeps decreasing in each loop iteration. So you have to count the LSB position, you know, from the left side. Then LSB of X is actually a ranking function for this, and it gives you a bound on the number of iterations. This is another example where this thing happens. These two are very common patterns. But the pattern that I've written in the exercise is not very common, but it occurred, you know, once in a while. But the same example can be handled by exactly the same logic. Right? So you can prove that for this example, the value of LSB decreases in every loop iteration. Now, how do you prove it? Again, you need to have a decision procedure for bit vector theories. But I did not even talk about it. But there's a nice theory, and there's a reference you can look at it. But again, you don't have to implement it, because this is all well implemented inside today's existing off-the-shelf SMT solvers. So the solver that we use was Z3, which is developed by Microsoft Research. But there are other solvers also that are available, like Yikes. And have people heard of other SMT solvers? I'm forgetting names. Have people used SMT solvers before? How many people have used SMT solvers? Okay, so if you have not, then I would really encourage you to understand, you know, what they can do, right? So they support decision procedures. And it's always good to be in a position where you don't have to build formal reasoning tools yourself, where you can exploit all the formal reasoning that is already there inside SMT solvers, like, you know, SAT solvers. So earlier people used to think that, you know, if the problem reduces NP complete, you know, if the problem reduces to SAT, it's bad because it's an exponential time algorithm. We do not know for polynomial time algorithm. But so many engineering advances have gone inside SAT solvers that today you should consider yourself lucky if you can reduce your problem to SAT. So SAT solvers can today solve huge SAT formulas very efficiently. Now, SMT solvers are also catching up. So what's an SMT solver? SMT solvers can reason about, you know, Boolean formulas, but the Boolean variables need not be just abstract Boolean variables. They can come from different theories. They can be ground facts, like x is less than y, which is the theory of linear arithmetic, x equals f of y, which is a theory of uninterpreted functions. You can have talk about facts that talk about reachability or arrays and so on. So SMT solvers today are good for solving quite sophisticated queries, but relatively much smaller in size than SAT solvers. So these queries that we have are actually small in size. So SMT solvers are a great application for discharging these kinds of proof rules. So here's another proof rule that I have for data structure iteration patterns, where you iterate over a list. And you can imagine what this would pretty much do. If you can figure out that, you know, the distance of a pointer that you're using to iterate over a list to some other pointer keeps decreasing in every loop iteration, then the original distance between those two pointers was the bound on the number of loop iterations. So I would not go into detail here. You know, if you're interested, you can look at the slides more carefully. But you can get an idea about how to design these proof rules, right? So the methodology was that you examine the problem on a representative benchmark, you know, manually see, randomly pick up some examples, and see what reasoning would it take to reason about the loops. Forget about these fancy techniques, iteration-based, constraint-based, and so on. Just think, what is a simple heuristic that you can write to handle such loops? It will not always work, but in our case it worked. The problem was such, the benchmarks were such, the design patterns were such that this turns out to be a very effective strategy. So design one such rule, then implement it, and then see what examples it cannot handle, and see what next proof rule that you can design which can capture most of the low-hanging fruit again, and you repeat this process in an iterative fashion. Okay, so now let's try to generalize the problem a bit. Now we are going to talk about loop that has two transitions instead of just one transition. And the idea here is again that we are going to use proof rules. No constraint based, no iterative strategies, but we study them for good. We'll use them somewhere. So constraint based was used here, but only for the linear arithmetic logic. So whenever I talked about fixed point computation techniques, I also have to tell you the logic that I'm using to discover invariants there. For proof rules, I'm not writing down the logic, because for proof rules, I will simply use an SMT solver, and SMT solver today implements a variety of logics, including all the ones that we studied on the first day. But for constraint-based, I'm going to write down the logic, which is the linear arithmetic logic in this case. So now let's say you have two transitions, S1 and S2. Now you can use the idea that we discussed here to compute a bound on the number of times S1 is executed if S1 was the only transition inside the loop. And you can also use this technique that we just discussed to compute a bound on S2 if S2 was the only transition in the loop, right? But the loop does not only contain S1 or S2, it contains both of those transitions. So can you think of how can I compute a bound for a loop which has two transitions in terms of the bounds for the individual transitions if I knew it somehow using the technique that we just discussed? Like, can I just add the bounds together? So how many people believe that we can add the bounds? So we can use the technique that we just discussed here to compute bounds for a loop that has one transition. And imagine that the loop only had transition S1, compute a bound for it, and let the bound be B1. Then imagine that the loop has only transition S2, compute a bound for it, and let the bound be B2. Can I say that the final bound will be B1 plus B2? No, we can or we cannot?
We can.
So we can, but in some cases, not always. The reason is that the other transition screws up some of the variables of the first transition. So the first transition, you found a ranking function, which was under the assumptions that the ranking function was decreasing by 1 in every iteration. What if the other transition changes the variables inside that ranking function, and these transitions can interleave arbitrarily. So this assumption is not going to be true. So what I'm going to show you next is, when is it that you can add the bounds? So I'm going to tell you some sufficient conditions, which again can be discharged using the solver. In some cases, actually, you can multiply the bounds. And in some cases, you can take max of the two bounds. And these proof rules that I have on the next slide actually correspond to this. I'm not sure how much time will I have, but let me actually just talk about one of them. Actually, let me leave this one. Let me talk about, so what this proof rule is saying is that if some conditions are met, then actually you can take the max of the two ranking functions. And you can look at these conditions later and you can look at this example. But I'm only going to talk about maybe add proof rule, right? So when is it that you can add the ranking functions of the individual transitions that you can again compute using, you know, proof rules or constraint-based technique, right? If the non-interference condition is satisfied for both those transitions. So what does this non-interference condition say? So this condition really says that if R2 is a ranking function of S2, then S1 does not interfere with it. So what is the definition of interference? Forget about this non-enabling condition. Just look at rank-preserving condition. So S1 does not interfere with R2 if S1 does not increase the value of R2, right? So S1, the goal of S1 or the way the S1 is functioning, sorry, the way the S2 is functioning is it is decreasing R2 in every iteration, right? So this is how S2 functions. It decreases the value of R2 in every iteration. Therefore, we can conclude that R2 is a bound on S2. If you can show that S1 does not interfere with R2 in the sense that it does not increase back the value of R2, then we are fine. Right? This is called non-interference, that S1 is non-interfering with the ranking function R2 of S2. So if we have this condition both ways, then can you tell me what will be the bound of S1 or S2? It's exactly based on the intuition that you had. So what is it? You mean to say R1 plus R2. So S1, S2 are transitions. The bounds are R1 and R2. Did you mean to say R1 plus R2? So now this is a trick question. So now you have to be very careful. These proof rules are easy, but it's easy to get them wrong also. So how many people believe that if this non-interference condition is satisfied, then the bound will be R1 plus R2? So how many people believe that? Okay. So you're almost right, except that, you know, recall this max rule that I had at the beginning, right? The bound will not be R1 plus R2. It will be something else. What would that be? You have to use some max somewhere. Wonderful. I'm not sure if you already had access to the slides or not, but probably not, but I'm impressed. So the bound is indeed this, right? Now observe what is the beauty of this proof rule. This bound is actually a disjunctive bound, right? It's not an additive bound only, it's a disjunctive bound. And it can be used to compute, you know, bounds for several examples like this, and you can look at them later that these satisfy the non-interference condition, so you can compute the bounds, you know, using this proof rule. But if you were to compute the bounds using the simple counter instrumentation that I talked about on the first day, you would have had the need to compute disjunctive invariants, right? Because you don't necessarily know whether R1 and R2 are greater than 0. And now this proof rule is beautifully avoiding the need to compute disjunctive invariants by identifying a common design pattern that people have between different paths of their loops, which you can exploit, you know, directly by this simple rule, which checks some simple non-interference conditions. Right? So this proof rule has the power to compute disjunctive bounds for us without having the need to do, you know, disjunctive reasoning by essentially capturing a common design pattern, which we call non-interference here. Right? So you can look at this example. This example, I think, is the example. Which example is this? Example Q2. So did people try to work out the example Q2? It was not so easy. So how many people got Q2? How many people even did try Q2? This was in exercise 3. So see, that example is not very easy, but this proof rule will immediately give you the disjunctive bound. Now, if non-interference condition is satisfied one way, not the other way, then you can actually multiply the bounds together. And this is what the next proof rule is doing, but I will not go into the details here, but you can actually read the conditions, right? So this really says that if non-interference is satisfied one way but not the other way, then you can multiply to do bounds. But again, you have to do max and so on, and you have to compute, you know, upper bounds and so on, which are, you know, not really that intuitively interesting, but you can look at this slide in more detail if you are interested. So at the end, we actually came up with like three proof rules which can help us to compute bounds for transitions, you know, two transitions, the disjunction of two transitions. And the idea was that we identified the conditions under which we can compose those bounds by using the max operator. We identified conditions under which we can compose the bounds by using the plus operator and by using the multiplication operator. And these are three fundamentally different mathematical operators which are required to compute bounds of several programs that we observe in real life. And we were able to compute the bounds using these operators. All of them were hard, without having the need to reason about those operators, without having the need to design logics or, you know, design fixed point computation techniques to reason about those fancy operators. All the reasoning and orientation that you needed to reason about these operators was beautifully encoded inside these proof rules. But these proof rules are by no means complete. They will not necessarily, you cannot prove that they will give you the most precise bound in all situations. But empirically, we observed that they were good enough for most of our purposes. So now let's see how we can extend this to the case when you have multiple transitions, right? More than two. So again, I will probably not go into the details here. I have a slide which shows how to combine two of those proof rules, the additive one and the multiplicative ones. And the extension is not very difficult. And to combine, and this is actually mentioned on this algorithm. I will not go into the details here. I don't have time. But the idea is to combine the rules, you know, where you can add the bounds, and combine the rules when you can multiply the bounds in a more integrated manner when you have multiple transitions. And this algorithm is there on the slide. This algorithm does not make use of the max rule yet, because these rules interact with themselves in very funny ways, and max rule interacts in a very complicated manner, so it's not always easy. Okay, so now let me move on to the more technically interesting stuff. So now we talked about a methodology where you can compute bounds for a loop, and the loop has multiple transitions or multiple paths, but still a finite number of those transitions and a finite number of those paths. Now imagine what would happen if the loop for which you wanted to compute a bound on the number of iterations had nested loops inside it. If it has nested loops, you cannot enumerate all the paths, right? If it doesn't have nested loops, then you can enumerate all the paths, and each path will be what we're calling a transition, and you can compute bounds for it. So you compute bounds for individual transitions, and then use some proof rules to compose the bounds together. But if a loop has nested loops, then we cannot use this approach, right? To use this approach, what you really need to do is to replace the nested loop by its summary, right? And the summary is really the transitive closure of the transition system represented by the nested loop. So we'll just see an example on the next slide for this, right? So let's look at this example. Can someone tell me a bound for this example? Is this also in one of the exercises? Probably not. So let's look at this example. So this is a relatively easy example, not very difficult. Can someone tell me a bound on the number of loop iterations of the outer loop? It's not a trick question, it's simple, but I want you to think about it so that I can tell you, you know, what are the intricacies involved in handling such things automatically. It's not one. It's n. And the reason is that this inner loop can set flag to true at most n times. After this, you know, flag will not be reset to true, and then the outer loop will terminate. Right? So the inner loop, the inner loop can be described by this transition, right? N is greater than 0, the value of n is decreased by 1 in every iteration, and the value of flag is set to true. Right? This is how I just described the nested loop in a transition system representation for. Right? So now tell me, how should I summarize the nested loop in order to be still able to compute this bound of n? So what summary should I compute for this nested loop? And the summary should be described as a loop-free formula, right? As a formula. Formula is always loop-free. Just tell me in English language, you know, using English, how do you think, can you describe the effect of the inner loop to someone in order to be still able to compute a bound of n for the outer loop? So that we will apply once we get down to the situation when we have, then the loop is a collection of transitions. And then we'll apply all those proof rules, but we are not there yet, right? So our goal is to take this loop, which has inside it, reduce the nested loop to some summary so that the outer loop can still be abstracted as a disjunction of paths, disjunction of transitions. So the summary that we need for the inner loop is the following, right? We need to say that either the inner loop decreases n by at least 1 and sets flag to true, or it remains flag unchanged. So do people believe that this soundly represents the behavior of the inner loop? Right? So n prime denotes the value of n outside the execution of the inner loop, and n denotes the value of n that flows inside the inner loop. Right? So here n and n prime do not denote the value between any two loop iterations, but they denote the value before the loop and after the loop. Right? So what can this loop do? Either this loop does not execute when flag prime is equal to flag, it doesn't change the value of flag, clearly because the loop is not executing. Or if the loop executes at least one time, then it does set flag to true, but it decreases, strictly decreases the value of n by at least 1. Right? And n should be greater than 0 in that case. So this is what I call the summary of the loop, or the transitive closure of the transition system represented by the loop body. Right? In other words, this is a disjunctive invariant, right, that is true at the end of the loop, where n prime denotes the value of n at the end of the loop, and n denotes the value of n at the beginning of the loop. Right? So now let's see how we can automatically compute such transitive closures. Yes, you're right, but here is a non-deterministic conditional.
So the non-deterministic can change n or what?
It can. You can flip a coin randomly. So this is some. So the reason why it's there in the code is because it comes from some complicated conditional. It was like checking whether the a of n was equal to something or not, which you don't want to model, which is not important for the purpose of reasoning about this program. So for all practical purposes, you can think of it as flipping a coin randomly and deciding whether that is true or false. So if this is false, you don't execute the loop. If this is true, you keep executing the loop till it is true. But each evaluation of it is independent from the past evaluations. But that was a good point, because if I don't have it there, then this example is not interesting. Then you're absolutely right, this program executes for one loop iteration. Probably that's what you had in mind when you looked at this. So this is also a transitive closure, right? This also characterizes the value of n, relationship between the value of n at the end of the loop and at the beginning of the loop. But this is not a useful transitive closure, because this is too abstract to conclude even that the outer loop even terminates. Because if I replace the summary of the inner loop by saying that the value of n at the end of the loop is less than or equal to the value of n at the beginning of the loop, but the value of flag can be arbitrary, right? This is what this means. The value of flag can be set to arbitrary quantity, but n decreases. It's not good enough to even prove that the outer loop terminates. So you need at least be able to characterize this behavior of the inner loop to be able to compute a bound of n, or any bound, actually. And computing, and this is like the problem of computing disjunctive invariants. And disjunctive invariants is not easy to compute. And this is something that I did not cover yesterday, because the invariants that I talked about, by using this iterative fixed point computation techniques, were computing invariants in the conjunctive fragments of logics. So today I'm going to give you an example of how to compute disjunctive invariants. And this algorithm that I'm going to present is quite generic. You can add it on top of any iterative fixed point technique that you already have to compute conjunctive invariants. So the algorithm will be described at a very meta level. So let me just formally define what transitive closure is. Right? So you are given a relationship R, which represents the transition system of a loop T. And R is a transitive closure if R is implied by the identity relation, which says that all the primed variables are equal to the unprimed values, which essentially captures the case that loop may not execute even one iteration. Or the transitive closure is such that if I compose it with the transition system T, I get back the transitive closure. Right? This is a formal definition of what a transitive closure is. So given T, I want to find a formula R that satisfies these properties. And here is another example of transitive closure. You can work it out and check that this satisfies this property. Right? So we have this bunch of equations. Now we will solve these equations by using iterative fixed point computation techniques. So this is what I showed you earlier is that it is important to be able to compute disjunctive transitive closures and not just conjunctive transitive closure. If this was your transition, I'm sorry, my pointer is not working very well. So if this, S1 or SN was your given transition system of the loop, a loop had multiple paths, and you wanted to compute this transitive closure which had this form, which has m disjuncts, right? So S1 to SN is known to you. S1 to S1 prime is what you want to compute. then S1 to S1 prime should satisfy these conditions. And this is exactly the definition of transitive closure that I showed you on the earlier slide. I just explicitly mentioning the fact that the transitive closure that we want to compute is a disjunctive transitive closure. The second condition can be equivalently written as this condition. Now, here is the interesting observation that we noted about several loops that we observed, or actually all the loops that we observed from our benchmarks and from other people's benchmarks, that the required disjunctive invariance that you need to verify those examples satisfies a very interesting property. And we call this property a convexity-like assumption. Now, this assumption is not necessarily true for all disjunctive invariants, but all the disjunctive invariants that we have seen until now satisfy this assumption. And this assumption is inspired by the definition of what a convex theory is. And a convex theory is one of the necessary conditions that you have in order to be able to combine decision procedures. So this is something that I was not, unfortunately, able to cover in the first lecture. But if you recall, I said that Nelson Open gave a methodology to combine decision procedures for two theories, and that combination methodology was complete if the individual theory satisfied three conditions. One was disjointedness, and you have an example in the assignment to understand why that condition is important. The other was convexity, and the other was stably infiniteness, which is not a very technically interesting condition anyways, but convexity was an interesting condition. So what convexity says is that that if some formula implies a bunch of disjunctions of bunch of equalities, right? If some formula implies a disjunction of equalities, then it implies exactly one of those equalities. So this is a fact that is not logically true, but it is true of convex theories. Linear arithmetic is a convex theory. Uninterpreted functions is a convex theory. We are using a similar assumption here, but this assumption is not really convexity, because the convexity assumption says that when a formula implies a disjunction of variable equalities, then it implies one of those variable equalities. But here we have arbitrary formulas. These are not necessarily variable equalities. But if we just lift that definition where we say that it must be the case that Sj prime, the disjunctive invariant, one of the disjuncts in the disjunctive invariant, composed with a path in the loop, satisfies one of those. This should be a prime. I will fix it. So this is prime here. Read it, right? It satisfies one of those disjuncts again. So this is what we call a convexity assumption. We don't know what this disjunct is, and that's why we are using a map sigma of j comma I to denote this thing. So let me actually say this again, right? So the definition of transitive closure is that the disjuncts. So read this condition: disjuncts. The disjunctive invariant, when composed with the loop body, implies the disjunctive invariant again. Right? This is the definition of transitive closure. And this is what you want to compute. Now, the assumption that we are making is, and this is equivalent to say that, Sj prime, that one of these disjuncts, when composed with one of these disjuncts, should imply this again. Right? This is an equivalent definition. Now, the additional assumption that I'm making is that this pair, Sj prime and Si, should imply back one of those disjuncts. So this is a stronger condition, right? If the condition that I'm saying is true, this will automatically be true, but the other way around is not necessarily true. But for convex theories, if these disjuncts are variable equalities, then this is a definition of convex theories, then this is an if and only if condition. In our case, it's only one-sided condition. But quite surprisingly, we observed that all the disjunctive invariants we cared about had satisfied this condition, right? Which means that if you pick up one of the disjuncts in the disjunctive invariant, compose it with one of the disjuncts in the loop body, then there is some disjunct, so this should be a prime, there is some disjunct in the disjunctive invariant that it implies. We don't know which it is, so we are denoting that by the map sigma of j comma I. Similarly, a simple instantiation for the condition one is that id should imply one of those things. So again, this should be a prime. So I'm calling this delta. We don't know what this delta is. But now I'm going to tell you an algorithm where if you know delta, and if you know sigma, then this will give you precise disjunctive invariants. The most powerful disjunctive invariant that you can ever get by applying any algorithm, provided the domain is finite. It has finite height. The problem is that we don't know what the sigma and delta are. So one simple suggestion is that you can iteratively run this algorithm for all possible values of sigma and delta. So if n is finite and you want to discover a disjunctive invariant of a finite size, then there are a finite number of choices for deltas and sigmas. then you can choose any choice of sigma and delta and run the algorithm that I'm going to show you on the next slide. It will not scale if the number of n and m are actually large. So you will probably need some heuristics to construct this delta and sigma, and which is what we have, but I'm not going to talk about that. But instead, I'm just going to show you the vanilla algorithm, which, given delta and sigma, will give you the most precise disjunctive invariant that any algorithm can possibly give you. Now, what is very surprising about this observation is that people have done a lot of work on computing disjunctive invariants. And the key challenge in computing disjunctive invariants is that, if you recall, what was the join operation doing at merge nodes, right? Join operation, if you're computing conjunctive facts, then the join operation, instead of taking a disjunction, just combines them together somehow, right? It uses this join operator to merge the facts. And when you merge the facts, you're losing some information about your program. Now, when you want to compute disjunctive invariants, you do not want to always merge the facts. You want to keep them separate, right? But if you always keep them separate, then the number of disjuncts will keep growing. So you need some kind of heuristic which will tell you when to merge disjuncts and when not to merge disjuncts. So most of the papers that I know about disjunctive invariants, they come up with some semantic heuristic to figure out when to merge different disjuncts and when not to merge. So they come up with some notion of distance between two facts. If the two facts are already close to each other, it's okay to merge them. But if they are very far away, then it's not okay to merge them, and so on. Now, what is very surprising about this observation is that this construction, or as I will tell you, that the sigma and delta actually gives you a syntactic way of merging facts. This observation is completely syntactical. It's not semantic at all. So let me actually show you this algorithm and come back to this observation. So given delta and sigma, I will show you an algorithm for computing disjunctive invariants. And this is the algorithm. This algorithm is quite simple. I'll just show you, right? So just follow what is happening in this line, right? Now, in order to compute, disjunctive invariants, let's say that I know a disjunctive fact at the beginning of a loop, and I'm going to push it across one body of the loop. So a disjunctive fact, when I'm going to push across one body of the loop, how many disjuncts will I get? So I have m disjuncts to start with. I'm going to push each one of them across a loop body that has n disjuncts. So how many disjuncts will I end up with? M times n, right? Now I need some kind of criterion to merge those m times n disjuncts back into m disjuncts. And this is what every paper does, right? The way they decide to merge the m times n disjuncts into m disjuncts is to use some semantic criteria to decide which two disjuncts are not very far from each other and then to merge them. And this criterion is very domain specific. The surprising observation here is that you are better off using a syntactic criterion for merging. Forget about what those facts are, because this criterion is the one that is going to give you the best invariant. And the map sigma and delta, the map sigma actually is exactly the merge criterion. So recall what sigma was. Sigma was mapping a pair j, I to some value which was between 1 to m. And this exactly tells you what to map, right? So it says that the j and ith combination, that should be merged with sigma of j, I. So all those j and I pairs that map to the same index, which is specified by sigma of j, I. So sigma is a mapping that maps j, I to some number between 1 to m. Then you use this map sigma to decide your merging criterion. Right? The algorithm is as simple as this. But again, the problem with this algorithm is that it does not know what the sigma and delta is. Right? So the simple suggestion is that you enumerate, run this algorithm for all choices of sigmas and deltas. You can do much better, but I don't have time to talk about those things. Right? But I just wanted to give you an insight here that here is a construction that can compute disjunctive invariants by just using some syntactic criterion for merging facts. And also, I just wanted to give you a flavor of, how do you compute disjunctive invariants using iterative fixed point computation techniques. Okay. So now, there's two other things that I wrote on the slide here which I did not talk about, right? So when a loop has multiple transitions, I said we are going to use some extended form of these proof rules. But one other observation is that before using these proof rules, you do the control for refinement. And this was a program transformation that I talked about earlier. And then these proof rules would be quite effective. Similarly here, when loop has nested loops, right, we are going to use an abstract interpretation style algorithm to compute disjunctive summaries for the nested loop. But before doing this, you should actually do the quantitative attributes instrumentation, which will almost arithmetize a program that is manipulating lists and heaps. Then you can do this abstract interpretation on linear arithmetic and uninterpreted functions. And it will give you the precise invariance for most of the nested loops. Okay, now let me move to the final challenge here, which is about bounding the visits to any arbitrary control location, as opposed to bounding the number of iterations of a loop. And the algorithm is quite simple. What we are going to do is we are going to generate a transient system for pi. Now, I have to just define what is the meaning of transient system for pi, right? Transient system of a loop is very clear. We look at the loop, enumerate all the paths, and the set of those paths becomes a transient system. If the loop has nested loops, then we summarize the inner loops using this, you know, disjunctive summaries. Now, I just have to define you what does transitive system for pi means, an arbitrary control location. It's quite simple. You split the control location pi into two parts, pi n and pi start, and you recursively generate the transient system starting from this back until this. Right? Enumerate all the paths between pi start to pi end. Because the meaning of a transient system essentially is that it should capture how variables are changing in two successive visits to the same location. And after you do this transformation, then you enumerate all the paths between pi start to pi end, and that will give you the transient system. And you can always do this if there is no nested loop between pi start and pi end, if it's a DAG. But if there is a nested loop, you do exactly what we discussed. You replace the loop by its summary, right? And then you can recursively generate the transient system between two control locations. So does everyone understand, like, how do I generate this transient system for pi? Right? I just try to enumerate all paths that start from pi and come back to pi. The only challenge is if I see loops. But if I see loops, I will replace them by their summaries. Right? It's as simple as that. So this is the elusive algorithm for which we spent, you know, almost two lectures, and we finally arrived at this algorithm. Now I think I just have one more slide after this before I finish. But let's see, you know, what all we used most of the principles that we studied here. So where were all those principles used, right? So I actually told you this algorithm in a bottom-up manner, which is always a good idea, you know, how you should think about designing algorithms to your program analysis problems. You should first do the simpler setting and so on. But now I'm presenting the algorithm in a top-down manner, right? So you're given a control location pi and you want to compute a bound for it. The first step is to generate a transient system. And a transient system essentially is a set of paths which characterize how do variables change in between any two visits to pi. And the key idea here was that we will first try to arithmetize our program, because the program is using, you know, bit vectors and lists and so on. We don't want to reason about them. We can replace them by the quantitative attributes which the user has provided. And then we will need to summarize the inner loops. Right? So remember, these three different colors are talking about three different dimensions in invariant generation. So the blue thing is the program transformation. This is the fixed point brush that I was talking about. When I talk about a fixed point brush, I also have to tell you the logic over which I'm using it. I'm not writing down the logic with proof rules, because for proof rules, I use an SMT solver, and SMT solvers typically implement the addition procedures for several logics anyways. Right? So this essentially summarizes the key ideas how we generate the transient system. So we use this program transformation, we use this fixed point brush, we use this logic. Then to compute a bound for a transition, we use control for refinement, which is another program transformation, and then we use several proof rules. And occasionally, we can also use this constraint-based technique for computing linear ranking functions if proof rules is not good enough. So this is almost there, except there's one thing which I did not talk about. I'm not sure if someone noticed it or not. But this bound that we have computed is in terms of input to the transition system. It's not in terms of input to the procedure inputs. So for that, we need to just take this bound and push it backwards up. I'm not going to talk about that. I don't have time to talk about it. But the technique that works perfectly well is a backward propagation strategy as opposed to forward strategies. And a backward propagation strategy that's not based on iteration, but that's based on proof rules. And I gave you one example of a proof rule, if you recall, where I was trying to relate, compute an upper bound on the value of a loop, or on the value of a variable at the end of a loop in terms of the value of a variable at the beginning of the loop. So that proof rule is there in the slides. That proof rule is very handy in computing this. And this is the elusive algorithm that we are trying to come up after all this discussion. So this is my final slide. And you know, I feel that this symbolic bound analysis is an important problem, which can benefit from all the advances that we have made in static program analysis technology. But this technology or this formalizing has been used more to check correctness, which is a Boolean property, you know, whether your program is correct or not. But here is a quantitative property which can give much more meaningful information to a programmer. But it pretty much uses the same logical reasoning that we already understand. A Boolean version of this problem would be to check whether a program terminates or not, right? But that's not very interesting. You want to know how long the program takes to terminate. You want to compute bounds for it. And there are two important, you know, open problems that I see in this area. One is how to, you know, build such an analysis for concurrent programs. And so the techniques that I described are for sequential programs. And the other thing is that when I talk to people, a class of people, they say that, you know, worst case bounce is not very useful. What's more useful is average case bounce. Now, to even formalize this problem is challenging because you need to talk about a representative benchmark or a workload. It's not clear to me how we can compute that. So some situations you require worst case bounce, like, you know, if you want to compute real-time bounce on controllers inside, you know, aircraft and so on, you want to really meet hard time deadlines for all the worst case is important. But in some case, you might want to worry about the average case bounce. And to solve this problem, you know, we talked about three different dimensions in invariant generation. So these techniques that I talked about are not necessarily applicable just to bound analysis, but I hope that you will find them useful for other program analysis problems that you probably face. And for the particular case of bound analysis, it's not like, you know, one particular thing helps here, but a variety of choices were applied at a variety of places while trying to build up a solution for this problem. And that we felt was an effective strategy here. So thanks for your attention. So I'll conclude now. Be happy to take any questions in the break if you have any. I'm sorry I could not cover this assignment, but let me actually just mention two problems, two quick problems. So did someone try to work out why problem number two? Why, if I compute a bound on a counter at the end of the program, is that unsound? Fresh counter, it's only getting incremented. And problem is also interesting. There's a very simple one-line answer to problem number 2 and 6. So why don't you think about it in the break if you're interested, and then chat with me regarding the solution. I don't want to give away the, you know, real takeaway message here. But you know, why don't you think about it, and then if you're interested, come and chat with me and I'll tell you the solution. So if you just do problem 2 and 6, I think they're quite illustrative of some of the techniques that we discussed. Okay, thanks.